Let me introduce you to my sofa guest today, Suffolk Boy. He's travelled the world reporting the news. Humphrey Hawksley worked for the BBC since the 1980s. He's written for loads of newspapers, but he's living the dream because he says when he left school, he wanted to be a foreign correspondent and to write thrillers like Alastair MacLean, and he's done both. So congratulations and
well,
welcome.
Touch wood.
Yeah, well,
it's still going on.
Do you still work for the BBC as well?
No, I'm off staff from the BBC now. But I think the BBC is a bit like Hotel California. You know, you can check out, but you never leave.
So they give you a ring every so often.
Yeah,
or as well.
I give them a ring every so often, and something gets on air.
And because you've written loads of books, haven't you? Both non-fiction and fiction.
Yes, I wrote my first one about 20 years ago when I was the BBC's Beijing correspondent, and that was called Dragon Strike, and that was a sort of fictional military scenario about what would happen if China set up bases in the South China Sea and tried to take it over for its own, and that blew up into a sort of, what would America do, what would China do, what would Russia do? And it did very well, and it's actually still selling very well. And whenever you hear this thing of Donald Trump's trade war or stuff going on like that, you always see a little bit of spike in the sales there. But amazingly, now, of course, there is, you know, problems in the South China Sea, and China has built military bases there, and it is at odds with a number of the neighbours there. So you project something forward, and then you bring the strands together. And actually, these things sort of do unfold pretty much in a way.
I hope they didn't read the book. Could we blame you for it?
Well, the Vietnamese translated it into Vietnamese, and they teach it at their military colleges. I didn't get a penny for that. That was all sort of pirated copies. The Chinese, of course, sort of studied it and that, but they were going to do it anyway. So when I was in 1995, I spotted the first claims to the South China Sea Islands. We did a piece for the BBC News on it. And then, of course, China does things very, very slowly. So whenever somebody in Whitehall or Washington says, well, we really should stop those people building military bases in the South China Sea, there's something else going on. There's Brexit going on, or there's a Middle East going on, or there's an earthquake somewhere, or there's a flood somewhere. So that all gets put to one side, and then suddenly we wake up 20 years later and they run the place.
They've done it.
They've done it. And nobody can do a thing about it.
I mean, having travelled so much, you have got so much background to do these sort of spy thrillers anyway, haven't you?
Well, yeah, I think so. I like to think so. I mean, as a correspondent, you can do a lot for news stories and a bit of documentaries. But as a broadcaster, as you know, the clock is always ticking. So how much can you get into that extra 30 seconds or that whatever, whether you're cutting a television piece or a radio piece, you're always pushed. And I thought that it was very frustrating. And I thought, can I tell a story and sort of learn about it myself, and the readers can pick up stuff, completely fiction, and see if that works or not. And when I was growing up, I remember some of the great books that I read, like Leon Uris's Exodus. Now, I read that, and I was completely captivated by it, and that is the basis of what I know about the creation of Israel. Not by reading or listening to documentaries and that, it was that basis of it. And then, I mean, there was an author called Arthur Haley, and he did airport and ships or whatever it was, and I learned how an airport was being run, but it was all fiction. And I thought, well, could I sort of go to a place that not many people know about and tell that story? So the thriller that I did before The Man on Edge, which is the one you're holding at the moment, was called Man on Ice. And I decided when the Ukraine was blowing up in 2014-15, I thought, OK, so this is Russia against America, essentially. You know, Europe's a bit of a proxy always in these things. Where can I go that the PAC's not going to? So I got out an old Times Atlas, and I thought, and I looked at it, I thought, holy Moses, I thought. They had two islands in the Bering Strait, which is where Alaska and Russia sort of meet. They had two islands which were barely 2 miles apart, and one was a Russian military base, and one was a village of 80 Americans living on it. I've got to go there. I mean, nobody really knows about this thing. So I then went there, did a piece for the BBC on it. You get up every morning and you see this sort of Russian islands spread out like a huge sort of monster in front of you. And if you had some very powerful telescopes that the guys there had, you could see the Russian watchtowers along there. But what was amazing to me is that here you had these two superpowers. You know, they'd fought the Cold War and they were about to fight something again, and we didn't quite know what was going on. Not one flag, not one sort of marker boy, not one border crossing. And on the American side, not one military, not one policeman. It was just 80 civilians on this tiny remote settlement that you can only get to by helicopter. I thought, I got to write a thriller out of that.
I'm going to have to get that one.
Man on Ice, we call it, because it was all sort of frozen over. And then Man on Edge, the one that you're holding there, I thought, well, I've done that side of the sort of Russian thing. So I went up to the Norway border. And the Norway is the NATO border with Russia on the other side. And with climate change and everything, the northern passages are melting and ships are now going through there. And the Russians and the Chinese as well have got their eye on it, because these are going to be the shorter trade routes. So now there's going to be a sort of battle for the control of these trade routes. But again, like I was just mentioning with the South China Sea thing and the bases, China and Russia are working on that now. We're talking about Brexit still. We're talking about deals and no deals and all this sort of stuff. And then we're going to wake up in 20 years time and they're going to be owning those trade routes. Well. Yeah.
And is Rake Azena, have I pronounced him right? Because I only do
right.
It in my head, of course, when I read it. Like, so he's your hero. And was he in Man on Ice
yes,
as well?
Yes, he's the hero of Man on Ice. And in fact, just yesterday, a very kind endorsement came in from Nelson DeMille, who's a great sort of hero of mine and thriller writer, who said that Rake Azena is a hard, tough hero, and we should be glad that he's on our side.
But was it interesting creating him as your hero?
Yes, I created him. He's a native of this island that I was talking about, and I sort of created him. I said, well, nobody's sort of obviously got a hero from this island, so he's going to be unique, so whatever I do with him.
Happens.
And then you have that very tough, rugged upbringing that, I mean, let's face it, the Suffolk coast is not that different from that in the wild times. So you see these weathered, leathery sort of eyes, situational awareness, fishermen, you know, on the coast of Aldborough. You've got the idea of the sort of mentality of the people there, although far more remote there. And then I sort of put him in a situation where he's been trained in the military. He's fought in Afghanistan and Iraq and that sort of thing. So he knows what it is. But also he's instinctive with nature. So he doesn't need a sat-nav and that. He can tell by the way the wind is blowing and the waves are whipping up and the sun is not shining or shining in that part of the world and the birds fly out of the rocks. He can tell where the danger is. He's got an instinct like
so
that.
So in this one, he's stuck in the snowy wastes or whatever. He knows how to survive.
He knows how to survive. He said he gets tripped up a lot of times there, and he has a sort of on, off again relationship with his fiancée, who, because they meet in these sort of critically sort of dangerous situations and get on very well and work well there. But when it gets back to sort of attempting domesticity, of course, they all fall apart.
Did anyone show you the sort of how to write a book? Did anyone say you have to have a love interest, or is it just instinctive to you?
I mean, I sort of talk to people and read things. I think a lot of it you have to structure properly. Those writers, I'm sure they can, you know, a bit like Mozart, you can, and it's absolutely brilliant. I'm not clever enough to do that. I have to sort of, I do a thing called what's called a scene box. So yeah. Every scene,
so
you know,
out.
Roughly what's going to happen, yeah. Never quite works out like that.
Well, apparently, because most authors tell me that actually characters do start to do their own thing in a way. Does that happen to you?
Yes,
sort of.
You have to be disciplined. And particularly if there's a character that's maybe just meant to be, a copper on the beat that is meant to have a couple of lines, then suddenly you see that he's far more interesting than the people he's dealing with. You have to close that in otherwise you sort of lose control.
Goes off on a tangent.
Yeah, it's very disciplined.
You've got a website, and I noticed that you did go dog sledding. Was that so that you would get experience?
Yes.
For this book?
Yes, yeah. I went dog sledding there. And then one of the fascinating things I've got to say in the sort of work I've done is and I'll get back to the dog sitting in 2 seconds, is the people from Suffolk that you bump into. So I was up there in, you know, on the Russian border in the Arctic, and the guy that comes out to take me dog sledding, he says, "Hi, I'm Kit." I said, "Hi, Kit, how are you?" And then we go off, and I said, "Oh, well, where are you from?" You know, like halfway. "Oh, well, you wouldn't have heard of it." He said, "I'm from a place called Framlingham."
No. That's bizarre.
And his father owns a business, and he was taking over the business, but he wanted a bit of time out adventuring and that. So he took me out on this wonderful trip, just him and I, along the Russian border, along frozen rivers, frozen lakes, and then we stopped mid-time, and he built what's called a snow hole, lit a fire, and grilled some salmon, and we had a fantastic lunch there.
Wow. That's fantastic. Are you able to sort of double up and write an article for someone about that, and then you also include it in your
book?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, I think I finished the book first, and then I did a piece for the Mail on Sunday, actually, on dog sledding there, and Kit's photograph is in it.
Fantastic. So it's Man on Edge, stars a chap called Rake Ozenna. And it comes highly recommended from me for what it's worth as well. Grew up in the county, didn't you?
Yes, born in Melton. I think it was called the Phyllis Memorial Home or something. It's a housing estate now, as everything is. And then my early childhood was around there, and then to near Bury St Edmunds, a village called Bradfield St Clair. Went to Ruffham Primary School. And then moved back to Sternfield again, where I was until I left school age 17. But I've always kept coming back.
Oh, was it Sternfield where your mum was brought up? She was christened in the same church.
She was incredible. She was in Sternfield Church. She was born the house next to the church, and then she was christened in that church, married in that church. And her funeral was in that church. And I thought, you know, when it comes to sort of community, you don't get much of that nowadays.
And the continuity
of that. And the church, of course, which is the size of this box, really. I mean, it was packed and overflowing because the whole village
knew her,
yes. And she ran a care agency, actually. So right through until she was 80. So she was well known because people would sort of call her up and sort of, "Help, I need a care for my elderly, you know, mother or father or something like that." And she would then provide them. And that was how she did her business. Yeah.
It's, as you say, the continuity. So I've had an email from Julie. This is, no, not Julie. I've got the wrong one here. Not that one either. Was it Julie? I shall have to have another look in a minute. I've had someone who's come through. Oh, there we go. Here it is. This is from Wendy Long, who used to be Wendy Barker. She says she thinks she knows you. She used to live in the same village, Bradfield St Clair, when she was little, and went to country dancing classes.
Yes, yes.
Do you remember those?
Yes,
along
I
with
think
her
it,
sister?
I wonder if she went to the. She would have gone to Ruffham School or the primary school in Bradfield St Clair. I do remember her.
Wendy, you're going to have to give us another ring. Ring 0800 141 2121. That'll get you through to Sarah and find out more. So country dancing. I mean, I can remember doing country dancing. Did you have to wear ginghams? Or you wouldn't wear a gingham skirt?
Yes,
I would have done.
Dashing White Sergeant. I should keep up with it, but the Dashing White Sergeant and all the other ones that you did. Yes,
I don't think they do it these days.
The reels. Do you do it?
No, I don't.
Schools don't.
Do you still do it?
No. I keep thinking I should, you know, or you should learn to. I've even forgotten how to waltz. Have you forgotten how to waltz?
Well, I don't think I ever really knew. We did have to do a horrible Strictly style competition one year for children in need.
And,
so most of us have fallen out of love with the whole thing, the whole idea of doing it in front of people.
Yes.
So you ended up going off to school elsewhere, though, didn't you, in the end?
Yes. And I'm not quite sure how or why that happened. I think it was either I failed my 11 plus, and I honestly can't remember.
I did.
You failed yours?
Several times.
Well, let's say I failed mine, and that meant that I would have gone to a school that was, you know, they didn't want me to, my parents didn't want me to go to. And then they found this cheap cut-rate public school, which is actually a private school, down in Kent. And it was an interesting place, actually, because it, it wasn't an Eton or a Harrow. It was basically a factory for the sons of missionaries, army officers, and diplomats and spies.
Were there spies?
Yes.
Is that where you got the idea?
I found out that they were... I found out the secrecy of diplomacy, you know, as you're living in the... You know, there's all this stuff going on about public and private schools now. And I tell people, you know, when they say that... I said, well, look, you know, it wasn't my choice. You just get thrown into a place like that, and you just have to make the best of it. And it wasn't until, you know, when can you make a choice now? When you're 18 or something, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe a bit earlier. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, but you know, it wasn't my choice to go there. So I think you just get thrown into these places.
It makes you what you are, doesn't it? It probably taught you to mix with all sorts of people, which I guess you've always needed as your job.
It teaches you that. It teaches you compromise and that you can't always get what you want. And also it taught me what we now call in our hostile environment courses situational awareness. So you walk into a room, who's gunning for you, who's supporting you, you know, all of that sort of thing. Because when you're at one of those schools, there's no out. You know, if you go to a day school, there's always an out at 4 o'clock or whenever. There's no out in a place like that.
You have to duck
and weave your way through, yeah.
So I know you went into the Merchant Navy, and I think you went and worked in Australia and did all sorts of things first. But so how did you end up becoming a foreign correspondent? I mean, you worked, was it Radio 4 or the Bulletin Desk?
Yes, I went, I became a journalist when I got back from my travels around Australia, firstly for a company on trade magazines, worst job in the world, where I was writing press releases about onyx ashtrays or something like that. And then I got a job up in near Manchester in a place called the Congleton Chronicle, which is one of those local papers where and we got a shoe leather sole allowance for your shoes because you had to sort of walk around, do the funerals and the weddings and all that sort of thing. Then back down to London to a place called the Fleet Street News Agency, where you did stuff for all the Fleet Street stuff. Then I got paid so little, and I think I had so many parking tickets I couldn't handle them at all because you had to park and rush to the thing and get a ticket, that I went to Australia and got a job on the Melbourne Herald, which I think was owned by Keith Murdoch, Murdoch's father at the time. And I landed there. And I they offered me and said, I'm sorry, we can't offer you very much. We don't know who you are. And they were offering me four times what I was getting in Britain. I thought, yeah, this is the lucky country. And then I went from there. I did the Hong Kong. And then I went back to join as a freelancer, the BBC Radio 4 newsroom or the Bulletin's newsroom at the broadcasting house. Where we put out the Radio 4 bulletins and the Radio 2 bulletins, and I think something went to Radio 3 that you did. And I did that for a couple of years, not liking it very much. I'm not a sort of stupid, sort of thinking, well, it is the BBC, so I should sort of stick it out.
I should enjoy it.
Yeah. And then went over to Bush House, the World Service. And from there I went to Sri Lanka, which was my first foreign assignment. And then I kept going.
Was there a plan, or did you just step through doors as they opened?
It was really winging it. I mean, I wanted to be a foreign correspondent because I had travelled so much and I'd met some of them, and you know, and I thought, well, yeah, this is what I want. And there was sort of heroes around. Donald Wise, who's a Suffolk man, used to be the big foreign correspondent for the Daily Mirror. James Cameron and people like that were sort of these sort of heroes that I had. And I thought, well, that's really what I want to do. So when I got to Sri Lanka in the middle of the civil war there, and, you know, bullets started flying and bombs were going off, I thought, oh, right, so this is what I want to do. Now what?
I was going to say, is there any preparation? Did you get training? Or
at that stage, we didn't get any training. The hostile environment training that I just mentioned, that really began during the Bosnian War. So you're back in 1992 there. And that's where they first started bringing armoured vehicles in, and you went to quite a sort of shoddy hostile environment thing. But it taught you first aid, which is a big thing, and how to be aware of what might be around. So don't just go and tread on the ground. There might be a mine there. check your car and make sure the wheels aren't going to fall off and all that sort of where to run for cover if something's going off. You know, can you identify where the cover is? Interesting stuff like the wall of the studio. You might, in the movies, you sort of have someone going there and then shooting around it. No, the bullet would go straight through. So that, yeah, it wouldn't stop anything.
So, but it didn't put you off? I mean,
No, it didn't put you... No, I don't think so. I think once you... It actually becomes part and parcel of the story. So the dangerous bits suddenly become dangerous, or you're driving along a road and you see a roadblock and that. But that's what the story is. So if you're going to cover the Bosnian War or the Sri Lankan uprising or some civil war in the Philippines or the Arab Spring or Iraq or Syria or that, you go into it knowing that's part and parcel of the story. You make your judgment risks on it and... No, touch wood, it's usually okay.
It's an amazing world we live in, isn't it, now, where people can actually be reporting from. I often think that, where you are reporting while this war is going on. Yeah. And we're almost onlookers, which is so bizarre.
I mean, my colleague, the late Brian Barron, who was a great correspondent, he and his cameraman, Eric Thara, they covered the 1975 fall of Saigon in the end of the Vietnam War. They had to wait sort of 3 or 4 or 5 days to get out themselves and then get the material out. Now, of course, you get it in instant time, and not from us, from anybody that's got a phone. So that, I think, really started coming to the fore during the Arab Spring, I guess. Over the past 10 years, you've got it, and then you've got... And the BBC set up a whole unit to verify this stuff. So who's sending it? Have they doctored it? Yeah. Who's, you know, and there's all sorts of stuff going on. And now you've got fake news and you never know what's what anything is. So it's much better to write thrillers. Because then that is fiction.
We can tell it is fiction. But I know you've just been, have you been on a cruise? I know you work with...
Yes, I've just come back from a couple of days ago from Indonesia with Fred Olsen.
Fred, thank you.
Which is a Suffolk company, isn't it? Yes.
And do you talk, because I think you talked, some of your books have been about, you know, wars and how wars have started and so on.
Yes,
they?
I did three sort of military scenarios. So they were sort of fiction, but they weren't based on sort of love and characters and guilt and psychology. They were sort of, you know, how would things pan out? First one that I mentioned earlier in the program, Dragon Strike, was about China and the US in Asia. Then I did a one called Dragon Fire, which was about India, Pakistan and China. And when that came out in India, it outsold Harry Potter in 2 or 3 weeks, which made me feel a little good at the time. And then I did one called The Third World War, which was actually everybody with everybody coming out. And strangely, that was a sort of post-Iraq book. But strangely, looking at it now, which I do from time to time, the actual balance of power is still very much there. That was essentially Europe, India, China, and Russia. And when I sort of played, I war game these things in my head, as it were, and it says that everybody gets into a position where they can't do anything else but destroy each other.
Or hopefully not destroy each other. So if you look back, what are the things you're most proud of? Because you did do some television documentaries, didn't you? And you set up a whole world campaign about children who were working in the chocolate trade.
Yeah, I think that would be the most, I don't know, it was journalism, the sort of the deepest thing that actually forced change on a very bad practice. And I really bumped into it by chance. When I was in West Africa in the Ivory Coast doing a story on something else, and I can't even remember what that story was, but I said to the editors, look, we've got these children that are working in the cocoa fields picking this thing that makes chocolate. And they said, no, we did a story about slavery, we don't need it. And I said, well, I'm going to do it anyway. And it had a huge impact because this cocoa goes to companies like Nestle and Mars and Cadbury's, and these are the chocolate people. And they were trying to deny that it was happening. And we went down and we found the children, and they were being trafficked. And those that tried to escape were having their feet beaten with glass so that they were cut and couldn't run away, and they had no school or anything like that. And ultimately, my colleagues, me and my colleague, we got something, an American piece of legislation came in telling the companies that they had to, you know, pull themselves into line on it. But they didn't, and it's still going on. And I've done a lot. I did cotton. I did bricks.
I was going to say, especially in the world today, when we're talking about, you know, sort of ethical trading and so on. If people really knew, I don't know. Did you find it hard coming back to this country, having been away?
I found it hard coming back. I found that particularly hard because I saw this thing and I rang up. I think it was Mars press office. And I just sort of said, look, I just want to talk to you about this issue with children thing. And instead of saying, yeah, well, we're doing this, that, and the other, they said, no, it's not happening. You're just lying. Like, and I went to the editor of the BBC that was dealing with it. I said, look, I'm new back in this country trying to get it. Am I crazy? Is everybody accepting that you have children sort of forfeiting an education and made into orphans and all the rest? And they said, no. This Britain works on two parallel universes. And there's these people and there's us. And we're going to headline your story. And then that story kept going for about 6 months until we got the American legislation happening. And then I went off and did gold and minerals that go into our computers, those rare metals in Africa. We did the brick kilns in India. Now, India, which is this democracy that we're all told is a democracy, they have, I think, about 10 million people who are classified by the UN as slaves. And the Indian economy basically works on these people right at the bottom who are really getting no money or no medical or nothing like that, no education. And I did brick kilns. They were making the bricks that go into the skyscrapers. And then we did cotton again in India. And we did sugar in Latin America. And again, it was interesting. The sugar industry, I think, was probably the most together. And I don't want to bring Brexit into this, but it's not really. The reason that they were getting their act together in Guatemala on the sugar is because they wanted access to the European Union sugar markets. And the EU was saying, you can't do it until you stop your child labour.
So it has some say.
So they did have some say in it.
On the Sofa with Leslie Dolphin on BBC Radio Suffolk.
Author Humphrey Hawkson is with us. Man on Edge is his latest book. So you've been doing them for a while now, haven't you?
Yes, I've been doing them in different genres because I did. I had a sort of spurt, and then it got very busy with the sort of Iraq and Afghanistan and the 9/11 and everything. So I stopped for about 10 years. And then I thought, oh, I better start doing this again. You know how you've got that sort of thing that you have to do? I said, I'd start doing that again. So that was when I did The Man on Ice, which came out a couple of years ago, and then Man on Edge now. And I'm doing a sequel to Man on Edge that I think...
Is this about Rake as well, then?
This is Rake as well.
Good old Rake.
Because the whole thing now is that you do these sort of character series. That's the market. And then the movie business has sort of taken a dip and the Netflix series comes in. So you have to sort of use the publisher saying, you've got to keep doing this.
Have you? No one's snapped up the film rights yet?
No, there have been a couple of conversations.
Because he would make a good TV character, wouldn't he? Or film character.
He'd be a sort of Charles Bronson, wouldn't he? You know, sort of rugged and that. But I'm a little experienced with movie deals now. You get a call or an email. And actually, 9 out of 10 of them, and they say, I'm an LA producer, and I can, you know, we really love this property of yours, and we want to do it, and can we fly over and see you? 9 out of 10, it's a guy sitting at a bar, a little drunk, who's just walked out on his wife, or wife has walked out on him, or something. So you just put it to somebody else to sort out before you.
And where is the next one set?
Ah, I think it's going to be somewhere in Northern Europe.
Okay, not Suffolk.
Not Suffolk. No, I don't I don't know how to bring Rake to Suffolk. Well, because he likes snow.
So he's going to always be in the cold
bits. He's going to be in the cold bits, but we might because the man on edge is the Norway Russia. So I think we're going to have to keep that sort of cold strip, Serbia or Germany or something like that.
And people can follow it on your website. And it's, if you just type your name in, it all appears straight away,
that's
doesn't
right,
it?
Yeah.
And you've got all your books on there, the talks you do as well.
Yeah.
And I see you're giving a talk to the Aubra Phoenix Club as well, of Phoenix Society.
Yes. I have a sort of talk that I do that I did on the Fred Olsen cruise and everything. And it's called something like, forging your role in Aubra's role in forging the New World Order. So I talk about, China, Russia, Brexit, all this stuff that's sort of making us realign our politics. And then I say, okay, now what's your role in all this?
So this is where Aubra fits.
Yeah, this is where Aubra fits into it, or this is where the Fred Olsen cruise passengers fit into it. Or I launched it originally, the sort of version of that talk at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. So where you have all these, the think tank wonks and the people that are former secretaries of state and that sitting there and asking them the same question. Because, I mean, let's face it, everybody seems to be taken by surprise by Trump and Boris Johnson and this and that and happening. You think there are all these universities, all these think tanks, all these people thinking about it, and they're still surprised.
They still didn't spot it. That's quite cool, isn't it? Being able to do lectures, go on some nice cruises, and I think you've got more of those coming up, haven't you?
Well, I hope so. Yes,
yeah, sounds
I hope
very,
so. Yeah.
Very civilized as well. Although you have to work for your money, don't you? So you have a final key question.
I'm terrified of these questions now.
I don't think there's anything too bad now.
Turkey for Christmas lunch? Absolutely not.
Oh, really? No. What do you have?
There's got to be a reason that we only eat turkey at Christmas. And is it? And just because it's a big bird. Now, I think, I'm not sure what it's going to be, but it could be salmon. Could be a huge whole salmon. It could be a leg of lamb or a goose or something like that. But I very much doubt it's going to be
a turkey. Do you cook?
I don't that much. I can cook. I can do scrambled eggs. And
well, don't you?
I can do steak.
You've travelled the world. You should be bringing back recipes from around the world.
That would be a very good blog to do, I think.
It would.
I keep thinking recipes or restaurants in obscure places.
So have you got favourite food from around the world?
I like Asian food. I mean, I could live off Asian food without ever having a burger.
And you've never decided to live anywhere? I mean, if Suffolk is obviously one of the places you keep coming back to.
I'll rephrase what I was about to say there. I like being where I belong because you can kick up a fuss, can't you? And you say, well, I actually belong here. Whereas if I was living in the States or in China or something, somebody can turn around and say, well, you don't actually, you're not a citizen of China, so be quiet.
So that's a very good reason for staying here. Yeah. We'll watch for you shouting in the future. Thank you ever such a lot for coming in.
Thank you,
and
Leslie.
Taking so much time and have a lovely Christmas. Man on Edge, Humphrey Hawksley, and then look out for the next Rake Ozenna thriller.